need to pray for them. I remember growing up when I was in Adventures and Pathfinders, camps like these were things that stayed with me forever. And I do remember them making a big impact for me in my life. So I know that's what will happen to this, the same to our youth. So let's continue keeping them in our prayers. But yes, let's get into today's message. So Elmo, yes, the red Muppet from Sesame Street. Last year, he was on the news because someone hacked his X account. Now, X is what now used to be Twitter. But yes, we live in 2026. Elmo has an X account, a social media account. And that got a lot of attention. That got a lot of news. But surprisingly, that wasn't the most popular thing that happened on his account. In January of 2024, Elmo put a tweet out, or exit, that said, "Elmo, just checking in now. How is everybody doing?" That was a terrible Elmo. I can't do it. But this post received over 225 million views. And this is just a normal, there's nothing special about this post. This is just an innocent, innocent post. But he's just checking in. And this post, yep, received 225. It also received almost 20,000 responses. And Elmo is popular, but he's not that popular. But most of the responses, a lot of times in social media, are jokes or memes, which I love to read. But people really started to open up to this post that Elmo put. And things like, "Elmo, we are tired. Elmo, the world is burning around us." Or what about this one, this heartbreaking one? "Elmo, I lost my job. My wife left me. I'm behind on loans. I'm losing my house. I'm suffering." And even this one: "Every morning I cannot wait to go back to sleep. Every Monday I can't wait for Friday to come. Every single day and every single week for life." Now, when we start trauma dumping on a Muppet, that means that we're not okay. But this, what this viral moment revealed was that beneath all of the smiles, all the pictures that we post online, all the "I'm fine's" people, we are really hurting. And maybe we are as well. Have you ever gotten to the point in your life where you whispered your own version of "Elmo, I'm tired"? "Elmo, I don't know how much longer I can go on." Because this moment, what these people were responding to, didn't happen in just a vacuum or a one singular moment. A lot of us have noticed that something in our society, something in the world, has shifted from the economic instability, the rise in inflation, the wars that are going on, the shootings, the racial tensions, and the political polarizations. But sometimes it feels like our world is running in fumes, and we feel the pressure of it. And sadly, even our younger generation is feeling that as well. There was a survey done, 1,600 children and young adults, mainly Gen Z, between the ages of 10 and 24, they were asked to prioritize or rank the goals of their life. And this list included the normal things like happiness, belonging, success, money, power, popularity, and fame. But surprisingly, none of these items made it to the top. And it wasn't even close. According to this survey, the number one goal for Gen Z, for our young adults today, is safety. Safety, they just want to feel safe. There's a whole generation growing up, not trying to live their best life, not trying to make it, but just trying to survive it. So what do we do when the world hits harder than we expect? What do we do when the stories we're writing start to unravel and the future seems dim? What do we do when the storm takes everything? And today, we're going to be walking with two people who face this same question: a desperate man and a despairing woman. Two storms, one question, the same one that many of us face today. What do we do when the storm takes everything? So let's turn our Bibles to the book of Luke, chapter 8, verse 40. Luke chapter 8, verse 40, our verse for today. So let's enter their story. Read with me. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. So what we're reading is a continuation of when Jesus first, before this, in the same chapter, Jesus calmed the storm. And then when he reached the other side, he saw the man that had demons in him. And the story where Jesus casts the demons out and throws and puts them all in pigs. And so when he got back from that moment, this is where we are. He's back now, back to his own side, back to his own people. And Luke is clear that they welcome him with open arms when we read that. They wouldn't follow Jesus to the other side of the lake because there were the Gentiles. And they believe, these people believe that the Gentiles were contaminated, but they welcomed him back, eagerly welcomed him back with open arms. But even with this land filled with people who pride themselves as being God's own, something is wrong. So let's now go to verse 44. We're still there in Luke 8, 41 is the next verse. And it says, and there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house. So the irony of this position is that this man who is respected finds himself in the exact same position as the man who Jesus just removed all the demons from. We read in Luke chapter 8 at the beginning of the chapter, Luke chapter 8, verse 28, it says, when he saw Jesus, this is the demoniac, Jesus out, and he fell before him and said with a loud voice, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I beg you, do not torment me. So this Jairus finds himself at the same exact position as the demoniac. Now Jairus on paper, he had everything. He had power, he had prestige, he had wealth. So what could bring Jairus, a man like this, down to his knees? Luke continues. For he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. So let me ask you, what would you do to save your only daughter? Now, Andrea and I, we don't have kids, but there's a comedian called Michael Yo, and he has this bit about what it's like when you have your kids and the irrational, immediate love you have for your kids. So he says, when my son was born and the doctor handed me my son, it's crazy as a father because I knew I would die for him. I don't even know this dude. He could be a terrible human being, but I would die for him. But when they handed me my daughter, oh, that was different. I was like, okay, I would kill for you. I became a murderer overnight. The dynamic of my family is crazy because I would die for my son, but I would kill for my daughter. How many of you can relate to that? So because there's almost an instantaneous, irrational love for our children, so what would you do to save your only daughter? And that's the dilemma that Jairus faces. He's about to lose his daughter just as her life is starting. Luke says that she was 12, and in Jewish society, 12 was the year that a girl became a woman. So just as her life is about to begin, this illness is going to snatch her away from Jairus. And that's what brings Jairus to his knees and the feet of Jesus. Desperate faith, the storm is about to take everything. So he pleads with Jesus, Jesus, come with me. And Jesus follows. And you can just imagine Jairus trying to pull Jesus with him. Come on, let's go. She's very sick. I need you to get to my house to help her. If there was an ambulance that day, Jairus would shove Jesus in there and try to get him as fast as possible to his daughter. But there isn't, so he has to push through the crowd, the suffocating, pressing crowd. Let's turn now to verse 42. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him. Now, the word pressed that Luke uses here is only used twice in the book. And we read this in the beginning of chapter 8, where Luke is talking about, or Jesus talks about the parable of the seeds that he throws, and when the plants grow, the thorns suffocate or press or choke these plants. And so that's what Luke is picturing here as well. When Jesus is coming, walking through, and the crowd, they're like thorns pressing or choking the life out of Jesus' mission before it has a chance to start. But they, these people, are not the only one in the way. There's a woman there, and she's in the midst of her own storm. And that's been raging, this storm that's been raging for this woman has been raging for 12 years. And so Luke continues, and let's read verse 43. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all of her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. Now, as far removed as you and I are from Jewish purity culture, it's difficult for us to feel the weight of this woman's illness. So there is a commentary made by this guy named Joel Green on the book of Luke. And I want to read you guys a chapter of him talking about this woman. So it says, "The simple fact that she is a woman in Palestinian society already marks her as one of relatively low status. In addition to this, she was sick, and her sickness, while apparently not physically debilitating, was socially devastating. Her hemorrhaging rendered her ritually unclean, so that she lived in a perpetual state of impurity. Although her physical condition was not contagious, her ritual condition was, with the consequence that she had lived in isolation from her community these 12 years." So see, according to Mosaic law, anything this woman touched became unclean, and anyone who touched her also became unclean. And here's the difficult part. Those people who touched her would have to go, after going through a ritual cleansing process, they had to isolate until evening. So you can see how quickly one accidental touch could completely derail your day and her day as well. So they had to isolate, they couldn't work, they couldn't interact with other people normally out of fear that they would also spread the contagion to them. And so when people found out about this woman's condition, they did whatever they could to avoid her. They shunned her. They rejected her for 12 years. 12 years this woman lived with this condition. And she tried everything. Treatment after treatment, doctor after doctor, using all of her money until her savings and her hope was gone. 12 years she lived like this. 12 years of isolation, 12 years without work, 12 years without touch, 12 years without a future. Now Luke wants us to notice this number 12. For as long as Jairus' daughter was living, this woman has been slowly dying. One life growing, the other life fading away. She's lost everything. She has nothing. She has diseased, desperate, and destitute. That's what she has become. So what do you do when the storm takes everything? And here's what this woman did. With a mustard seed of faith, she reaches out for the only hope she has left. She pushes through the crowd, this same crowd that has been pressing, choking around Jesus. The same crowd that has shunned her for so many times before. The same crowd that is now forming a wall between her and her only flicker of hope. She pushes through the crowd, she falls to her knees, and for the first time in 12 years, she reaches out to intentionally touch someone. And Luke underlines this word touch. He repeats it 4 times because he wants us to know that she understands what she's doing. She understands the risks. She understands the consequences. She understands the condemnation she'll receive if she is caught. But when the storm takes everything, it doesn't leave a lot of choices. So she chooses faith. She reaches out and touches Jesus, knowing that she can make him unclean. But that is not what happens. Instead, her impurity does not flow into him. His power flows into her. We continue reading verse 44. Luke 8, verse 44, we'll read to verse 46. And it says, "She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd surround you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out of me." Why does Jesus do this? Why does he stop? Why does he call her out? Why risk potentially exposing her shame? Why? Wouldn't it have been faster if he had just continued on? Maybe he would have made it to Jairus' daughter before she died. So why does Jesus stop? It's because Jesus' priority is not speed, it's faith. See, Jesus sees or knows there's something that can only happen if this woman steps forward. Her healing is not complete until it's acknowledged. So she sits at a crossroads. She is in a position where she either needs to make a choice of stepping back in fear or stepping forward in faith. See, Jesus, his goal is not to expose her shame. It's to expand her faith. He wants to show her that her faith can overcome her fear. Her fear of rejection, her fear of condemnation, her fear that even after being healed, she'll still have to live in isolation. Jesus brings her to the light not to wound her, but to heal her. And that's exactly what happens. Let's read verse 47 and 48. And it says, "And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed." She gives a testimony right there before everyone. And verse 48 says, "And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace.'" Jesus calls this woman daughter. And with that one word, daughter, he restores more than just her body, more than just her sickness, more than just her health. He restores her belonging. Probably no one called her daughter in those 12 years. She hasn't heard those words said to her in so long. And this woman finally finds peace. But Jairus, his storm, it's about to get a lot worse. Let's read verse 49. Luke 8:49 says, "While he was still speaking," talking about Jesus, "while Jesus was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, 'Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore.'" I imagine in that moment, Jairus' world went silent. He remembers his daughter's first breath, and he's imagining her last. And all the hope that he has collapses. Why? Why did Jesus stop? Why didn't he save his daughter before she died? But in that moment of despair, I want you to notice what Jesus says to Jairus. Let's read verse 50. "But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, 'Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well.'" How can he believe when he's just lost everything? What does faith look like when your future is over? See, this is Jairus' crossroad moment here. He can decide to either step back in fear, or he can do what the woman did and step forward in faith. And Jairus, grieving, broken, trembling, steps forward. He follows Jesus. Even when the crowds laugh, even when the mourners mock, even when it seems like death has the victory, he keeps following Jesus. And in following Jesus, he finds peace. Let's go back and read the rest of this chapter. Let's go ahead and read from verse 41 all the way to the end. And it says, "And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, 'Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping.' And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead, but taking her by the hand and called, saying, 'Child, arise.' And her spirit returned. And she got up at once, and he directed that something should be given to her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened." Now what Jesus tells them there, the woman preached and gave the testimony of what Jesus did, but in this situation, he told these parents not to tell anyone. Now, there may be something there. We don't know. We're not going to dive too much into it. But what do we do when the storm takes everything? We do what Jairus did. We do as the woman that was sick did. We take one trembling step forward in faith towards Jesus. Even while we fear, even when the future looks unclear, even when we don't know where following Jesus will lead, because we follow the one who writes stories that no, not even storms can end. So for both Jairus and this woman, it's faith in the midst of their storm that allowed God, Jesus, to lead them in peace. Now I want to be very clear because it's very, very important that we understand this. Not all of us is going to experience resurrection like this, like Jairus' daughter did. Not all of us are going to have miraculous healings like this woman did. At least not this side of heaven. Some of our storms will end in healings and others will end in heartbreaks. Because faith is not a magic key that opens the door to whatever we want. Faith is the courage to step forward, not because we know how the story ends, but because we trust the one who writes the story and walks with us through it. So let me ask you, what does that step of faith look like for you? What does faith look like in the midst of your storm? Maybe it's choosing to search for light in a world that's suddenly gone dark. Maybe it's inviting someone into your storm and to bear it with you, joining a grief share program so you don't have to weather it alone. Maybe it's letting go of control, trying to manage our storm or trying to manage all the storms around us, becoming obsessed and learning about these storms. Maybe it's instead letting go of control daily to the one who can manage our storms. Or maybe it's just refusing to give up and taking whatever step of faith that we can see next. I don't know what these steps look like for you, but I do know this. Jesus invites us all to follow him to peace. Now, I don't know how it was when you guys were getting your driver's license, but when I was getting my driver's license at 16, you had to go in 8 days before being able to get your driver's license, and you had to drive with someone, with an instructor. And how it worked with, now it's different. I don't even think that's even the case anymore. I think you just take a written test and they give you the license. But what I had to do was for 8 days, I had to go with an instructor. And it would be two of us. It would be me and another kid that was driving. So I would drive for an hour and then we'd switch. And the instructor was on the front and they had their brake pedal. But I was very confident when I was driving and taking the test. But when it was time to switch, man, I was in the back with people who were rough drivers. And I was like, there's no way they're going to give this person a license. But you start to fear about the people around you. The roads no longer feel safe. When you're driving, you don't really feel anything. You drive with one hand, you have the radio on. You think there's nothing's wrong is going to happen. Today, when I drive, Andrina hates how I drive, and she gets really, really scared. But when she's driving, of course, she's the best driver in the world. Nothing's wrong. But maybe you guys have felt that with your kids when you're driving with them. When you're driving, maybe everything feels fine, but when you're teaching your kids, the world is the enemy around you. And there becomes a lot of enemies when you're driving on the road. But when, this moment kind of struck me because when it comes to peace, peace doesn't depend on the road that we are on or the place that we're driving or who's driving around us, but it depends on whose car we're in. Peace doesn't depend on the storms against us, but on the Savior who is for us. Following Jesus doesn't make this world a less hostile place. It doesn't. When we drive, it doesn't make the world around us a better place, or when someone else drives, it doesn't make this world a worse place. Following Jesus doesn't make the road smoother or the storms fewer. Following Jesus doesn't guarantee that the road is easier, that the driver is better. Our peace doesn't depend on eliminating all the dangers around us, but in trusting the driver beside us. The good news is that the storm can take everything, but it cannot take the Savior. It cannot take the one who calmed the winds and waves just with his voice. It cannot take the one who healed a bleeding woman with just his garment. It cannot take the one who stepped into a room full of death and brought forth life. You think your hope is buried? You think that your future is done? People maybe tell you, don't bother the Savior, it's over. But Jesus leans in and he whispers, do not fear, only believe. one more thing that this story teaches us. This story is not about just these two people. It's not about Jairus and the woman who is sick. This story also talks about the community that surrounds these people. Tragically, the same crowd that welcomed Jesus when he came back from the other side of the lake with open arms, the way the people who, these people, they needed him the most. Tragically, these same people blocked Jesus from the sick woman, blocked Jesus from Jairus. And we, you and I, sit at the same crossroads. Our church is in the same position as these people. Like every community that follows Jesus, our choice is whether we will be a barrier or a bridge, an obstacle or an opening, a crowd that chokes, a crowd that presses around Jesus, or a community that cares. Because the world doesn't need another church that will only welcome Jesus. It needs a church that will embrace both the Jairuses in this world and the nameless women, the orphans and the foreigners, the outsiders and the outcasts. The world needs a church that makes a way and doesn't get in the way. So what kind of church will you and I be? Elmo, he asked a question, and the world confessed its storms. If he were to ask the same question of us here today, our answers may be the same. The only difference is that we know that there's someone else who's listening. And that same Jesus, the one who comforted a grieving father, the same Jesus who stopped for a bleeding woman, the same Jesus who walked into a hopeless house, hears us as well. And he doesn't scroll past our pain. He doesn't mute our storms. No, he leans in and whispers and looks us in the eye and says, "Do not fear, only believe." Amen. May the Lord bless his